That chanting that we did this morning, just in terms of Buddhist terminology, a good set of concepts to get your head around are the five khandhas that you find in the five skandhas in the Tibetan tradition. So we were chanting 21, we were chanting page 22. So we chanted page 22. Rupa Upadana Kanto in the middle there. Identification with the body, identification with feeling, identification with perception, formations, consciousness. So I use preoccupation with, I'm preoccupied with the body. So the way in Theravada Buddhism and in all the old forms of Buddhism, you define your sense experiences through these five categories: body, feeling, and feeling in this sense is a sense of something being, feeling's a difficult word because in English it connotes emotions and things like that, but in Nepali, vedana is simply the sense of being attracted to something and a sense of being repelled by something, and neutral. So that's a kind of spectrum of any sense experience has that. You feel cold, you feel repelled by the cold, you feel warm, you'll be repelled by the warmth, right? So that's a part of sense experience. Perception is the way we interpret. The glass is half empty, the glass is half full. This is a monk, this is a bald head, this is a lovely friend, right? And so on and so forth. So perceptions is how we build up our understanding of the world. So these are all necessary. Mental formations, the sankharas, all the constructs, emotional, and so emotions are both bodily, have both bodily in them, they have vedana in them, they have sankhara. So we don't have a fixed word in Nepali for emotions. It's this composite of, like if I feel anger, anger is both a physical feeling, it's also maybe a feeling of repellent, I don't like it, and also has a lot of mental structures in it. So that's how you define emotions. And then consciousness. And consciousness would be eye consciousness, ear consciousness, tongue consciousness, nose consciousness, body consciousness, and mental formations consciousness. Or in Western talk, we'd say the mind-body experience, or all your experience, you could say, all your experience. And the teaching on transcendence is basically that we have to be preoccupied with those things because that's how we live. So our radiator just blew on the truck. I almost had an accident. So if I just say, "Oh, it's not self, it's not me, it's not mine, it's impermanent," ain't gonna get nowhere with that truck. So that's when Buddhism gets really ridiculous. When you take the ultimate and try to apply it to the conventional, right? And then you kind of get kind of gulp. Usually, like people who are just beginning Buddhism, they kind of do that on you, and they're nuts. So there is conventional truth, and we need to be skilled in conventional truth, otherwise we're just preoccupied with it. But the Buddha's teaching is say, but there's also this other possibility. And the contemplative life, meditative life, is trying to do both. You're trying to live a good social life, live in the conventions that you have to live, take care of your truck and get the winter tires on and make sure that the fridge is working, all the things we have to do. But then also to not be preoccupied with the five khandhas and to see what happens when the mind doesn't always go out into thought, into emotion, into bodily feeling, and just knows it as a stream of conscious events. And that's the pathway to the transcendent, or that is the transcendent, actually, because in the knowing of an emotion as just an emotion, which has these components, and a non-preoccupation with that, not the dismissal of it, not the analysis of it, just the pure knowing of it, you begin to see what the word Buddha means. The word Buddha means that which is not attached. Or because the word attachment, I find people get confused by that. I find the word non-preoccupation is a kind of more interesting way to contemplate that. So I'll say to a parent, parents will say, I shouldn't be attached to my kids. I mean, well, how can you not be? It's absurd. But the preoccupation with a child's welfare all the time, all the time, all the time, that's something that can be looked at. So non-preoccupation. So on a retreat, we have a fabulous setup, you know, people cooking for us, and this lovely Dharma hall, and people, you know, it's all kind of set up for us. So for the conventional and social reality, there's very little we have to do. Just make sure you get your coat on. Difficult things like that. And don't spill your soup. But we have this kind of freedom now just to observe stream of consciousness rather than always have to engage and get things done. When we make efforts in the conventional way that we make efforts, we're always trying to achieve something. You know, we're trying to get the snow cleared off so that we can get the car out, so that we can get to work, etc. So there's always a sense of achieving something or getting rid of something or figuring something out. And that's only natural. So when we apply our efforts in the stream of consciousness, quite often we bring that into it. So there's a lot of anticipation in the way we make effort. We're trying to get something. Like as a monk, a monk's hang up is always trying to get insight. You know, it's like getting an ice cream cone. And I want to get some insight. So there's this kind of anticipation of whatever insight one might think, or trying to get jhana or some kind of meditative experience, or trying to reproduce or manufacture an experience one had 10 years ago and one was blissful and hasn't seen it since. You know, there's that one too. And so there is this that kind of strong sense of anticipation oftentimes in the way we make effort. And just to kind of notice that as an object of consciousness, right? Just to say, oh, anticipation feels this way. Hence, I like to use the word non-anticipation. So if you pop that in, it's kind of like, I mean, I've never done music, but I'm kind of interested in it. But if you're a piano player and the piano piece says fortissimo or something like that, that's kind of reminding you how to play the piece. In the same way, you're trying to remind yourself with language how to play the piece. And non-anticipation gets you in touch with anticipation. If it's a demand, thou shalt not anticipate, then that's not a reflection, it's a hassle, it's a kind of tyranny. But just non-anticipation, then you start to look at this inability just to be with the present moment, just as it is. Especially when it's nasty or unpleasant or not beautiful, because you don't want that. And then the other is resistance. So we resist the way things are, aversion or not wanting. And if you start to try to get these three things, if you can get these in place, presence, right? So like I use listening for that, presence. And then observe that is hard to maintain. Presence is hard to maintain. One finds one, you know, you're planning something or worrying about something. So just that is a huge step in transcendent practice, presence. And then even in when you make your attention present in the moment, then you'll notice this sense of anticipating something or trying to get rid of what is. So I use those three principles to try to monitor where my practice is at, where the moment is at, right? Yeah. And then they are a practice. It's something that it's not you don't believe in it. You're kind of doing it all the time. You're doing it all the time. And then that kind of training should, hopefully, if it doesn't, you can get your money back, I'm sure, or something, bring you to the present moment. And then the contemplation is around change. Change and not self. The way I take the like we have this word anatta, most of you have seen that, teachings on not self. The way I do that word is I use its in awareness. Because when I get attached to my emotion, like I just had a friend that wrote to me from Singapore, and he something happened to him where he felt kind of really disappointed, and the disappointment stayed for 2 days. And he was really disappointed. The disappointment stayed for 2 days. And but he got the insight that, well, why shouldn't it stay for 2 days? So his ideal was, okay, so he felt miffed by something. And then it created this stream of disappointments and whatever. And then he kept saying, well, I should have got beyond this by now. You know, I've been practicing 10 years, but that's still, you know, that's still taking a position around, that's being preoccupied. Yeah? And then, oh yeah, well, why shouldn't I feel miffed for 2 days? You know, then when you come to that, then, oh, then there's just non-resistance, right? Or the anticipation of getting rid of miffed or that's in, where did I get that word anyway? Old English word. You see what I mean? And we so quickly take positions around how our consciousness should be and what's right and what's wrong. So the word non-preoccupation, I find at least, I find it really, for me, a very skillful word. Rather than a judgment on the particular quality of my sense experience right now. Non-preoccupation. So you're still there with it. Non-preoccupation. So that to me, that sets things up. And then sustaining that, you know, I mean, many of you know the language I use, but then I use two words, watchful and available. And available is a very interesting one because it matches non-obsession or non-preoccupation, just available. It's a very interesting word. Available, and some people, available to what? I want an experience, but no, just available. And if you're watchful, available, well, you're not taking any position with anything. You just know the way things are. And that I use for anicca, for change. So if I'm watchful and available, then what I'll notice is that a plan about building the monastery comes up into consciousness. So it's all right, but I remain available rather than get preoccupied with the plan, watchful, available. So if you, I mean, this is the language I use that I've sort of figured out around the basic teaching, so you kind of have to figure out yourself. But if you get the principle of that the Buddhist teaching has this, one stream of teaching is about conventional reality. It's about being moral, being responsible, taking care of one's family and one's environment, and take care of one's own body, and make sure the milk doesn't boil over. You know, that's the kind of conventional truth. And but then the other is looking at the experiences we have as a stream of consciousness, and not being preoccupied with it, and finding that sustained non-preoccupation with this movement takes you to that which is not moving, which is awareness. It's very interesting. By noticing change, you come to the change unchanging, which is awareness. And you have to be very patient with that. The desire mind, oh, what's unchanging? So you look for an object, trying to find an object. But all objects change. You know, they're always coming, going, coming, going, coming, going. And in our fascination or disgust or passion for or boredom with these changing objects of sense experience keeps us preoccupied. And so now we're just going to say, oh. So my friend felt disappointed that he was disappointed that he was disappointed, right? And you could see how he could just spin that one out for lifetimes. And then, it's all right. Yeah, disappointment feels this way. And trust in that, you know, really, really trust in that. See what happens. See what happens with that. So that's the way I kind of like to practice. So when I kind of give instruction in meditation, there's object meditation, where you take conventional sense of object, like breath, and you work with that to stabilize the mind. But if you just absorbed into that sense object, and really, really, really got good at it, you'd block everything out fine. You can get rid of your thoughts and your emotions can be put aside and all of that. But as soon as you take off that block, you got the old stuff again, right? So object meditation, I think, is necessary part of training, of just getting into the present moment, feeling the breath, feeling the body. But then, always to have to control the object, be with the object. You're like a horse in a horse box with blinkers on. It's kind of peaceful, kind of peaceful. But as soon as someone sneezes, you can get angry. Right? And that, you see, that's the sign, I'm not really free, I'm just controlled. So then you begin to experiment with stabilizing the mind on the object, but also stabilizing the mind through this suggestion of non-preoccupation. That's another way. And that's the freedom. Because then any object's okay. Good, bad, or indifferent, it's all okay. And then you find, that's where the real peace lies. That's where the deeper peace lies. Because that peace is not an object. It's that within which all objects come and go, come and go. And hence you have the ideas of transcendence or spirituality, whatever. That's the theory. Piece of cake when you when you've been saying it for 30 years. And get it out in 5 minutes and that's it. So, shall we try some of those ideas? So those three kind of three aspects. So first of all, presence. And how do you do that? Well, whatever. But say if you just listen. And then notice you're present. It's really not about the sound or lack of sound, is it? It's just that you make an intention to know the moment as it is through listening. And then right away, if you do that, notice that there can be this having established presence and the mind is looking for something, some experience, because that's the sort of restlessness of human consciousness, always looking out to objects. So presence, non-anticipation or non-becoming, non-anticipation. So it's a very receptive attitude. And then as the meditation progresses, you might feel a mood or a bodily feeling that you don't like, and so non-resistance, non-resistance. So I would suggest you get that first when you start. Get that balanced attitude right. So presence, non-anticipation, and non-resistance. And then you begin to notice what prevents presence. You feel sleepy, you're worried about something. And then you notice preoccupation, non-preoccupation. So it is a training. And then just to help in that presence, so you hook your attention into, you localize your attention to something ordinary going on right now. So you take bodily feeling and begin maybe with the base of the posture. Pressure, warmth, vibration, and you allow your attention just to abide with that. So now you are, to some extent, preoccupied, but you're still available. You're watchful, available, and you localize that on a simple object like bodily pressure. And I notice if you just sustain that attitude for a bit, the bodily sensations come into consciousness. And the attention stabilizes in the present moment. And you begin to see what we mean by watchful and available. Then you move your attention somewhere else, say the spine. And maybe you start to feel sleepy. So then you do something more vigorous. So let's say we feel the spine and we stretch the spine. So you stretch the spine, feel it reaching to the ceiling, and you open the chest, but still watchful, available. So you put vitality into the system, but it's still non-anticipation, non-resistance. So you stretch the spine up, feel the head reaching to the ceiling. And that's really the basic thing you need to do for dullness and sleepiness. So as sleepiness comes in, you notice the spine collapse and you come back to stretching. You might have to do that for the whole meditation, just continually rising up, rising up. So let's say you're not sleepy, you relax the posture. And feel the whole body. So to do that, you have to sort of step back, as it were. And then the body starts to be noticed as a system of energies and vibrations, and then you wait, so that waiting and localizing attention stabilizes your mind in the present moment. And watchful, available. And if you like, you pick up the breath. And you ride the out-breath and the in-breath. Sustaining this balanced presence, non-resistance, non-anticipation. And if you tend to control a lot, if you're kind of tense in the body, then use that. This is happening in awareness. the breath is moving in awareness, rather than me being the person that's trying to control my breath. So you're going to step back. The breath is moving in awareness. It's a more subtle kind of suggestion. So that's a whole bunch of ideas. Let's just use those and try to stay awake to the way things are, breath by breath. So there's time lapses, the mind can get kind of fuzzy and dull and sort of habituated to meditation if you've been doing it a long time. So then you have to kind of crisp it up. And so you do something quite strong, like stretch the spine, and hold attention on that. And so the watchful available has this kind of more sharp object. And that sort of strengthens and ground and stabilizes the mind again away from the dull, fuzzy, wandering kind of mind. So you can hold an object. So we use object meditation, but not to block everything out, just as a skillful means to sustain presence. So don't be afraid to manipulate the breath, make it really stronger and deeper for a while, or play around with the spine, sort of get involved with the body. So you have something interesting to look at and do. But it's not to become, not to get rid of dullness, but just to know dullness as it comes and goes. So even if you're off to La La Land for 45 minutes, when the bell rings, watch La Vela. Rather than think, oh gosh, I wasn't available. Because then you're preoccupied again. Sometimes when I, not in this retreat, sometimes in a retreat, even at the monastery, the bell rings and everyone goes, wow, oh, made it. Survived 45 minutes and everyone moves around and so on. Yeah, it's kind of like holding on for these 45 minutes or whatever. But the watching the veil is a very relaxed kind of thing. And yet you need enough vitality not to fall asleep or whatever. So it's a gentle practice, but the rigor in it is remembering it, I think, moment by moment. So I might suggest, like during this retreat, just use that kind of a concept for awakening. So when you're eating a meal or you're having a shower or whatever, and available, it's like you can do really things. You can do things really well. You can do craft really well. You can do therapy very well. It doesn't deny participation. It just makes participation very open. So you might just use that kind of language. Watchful. I use that a lot. Obviously, that's why I talk about it. But I was in the dental chair in Bangkok 2 weeks ago, and about an hour of serious excavation going on in there. And you know what it feels like. I was just doing watchful, available. And I noticed that I was trying to relax the body. And then in trying to relax the body, I was preoccupied with the body. So I said, well, if you're going to be tense, be tense. And I just went back to watchful, available. It was very peaceful, but my body was tense. And it was a very interesting insight. Yes. And it was very, very peaceful. And the body, that's all right too. It's kind of like, it's the same, I think, insight my friend had. He realized that he was disappointed with disappointment. So he tried to relax the disappointment, as it were. And I was trying to do the same with my body, relax the body. Well, just relax, relax. I'm enjoying this, or something silly like that. Just watchful, available. And then the mind just kind of went to a really peaceful place. So it's got a lot of subtleties in it if you play around with it. And to have a practice so that you can do all the time is very important. Right? You don't want Buddhism to be a kind of cushion experience, a zafu experience. You'll be able to do it 24/7. So we have a few minutes, about an hour before lunch. So if you want to do some walking meditation, we just choose a nice warm path out there. 20-30 paces, and then mark the ends of the path and just move from A to B, B to A, A to B, to B to A. Watchful, available. Use your body and just do simple things, like when you start, feel cold. What does like coldness feel on your face? Because they're very grounding kind of suggestions. And then see if you have any reactions to that. Just cold feels this way. So that's what we mean by Dharma. When we say Buddha knowing Dharma, when you know cold is cold, that's Dharma. And then afterwards I might make a comment, oh, I need another sweater, or oh, I like the cold, or whatever, but this cold is this way. And keep coming back to that. And so walking meditation, you're just doing the same as sitting, you're just changing the posture. And then with a meal, look at the food and then just watch greed. It's a greed body. You know, if you weren't greedy for the lentils or whatever you're into, you wouldn't eat. So I used to really make a problem around greed. Oh, I should just be neutral. I couldn't do it because it was neutral. I wouldn't eat. Right. So like it's a greed body. So if you want more cake, fine. Just don't take everyone else's cake. But you know, it's just greed feels this way. It's the nature of the body to have that experience. That smell the food before, it smells good, and smell the kitchen or the dining room after, it doesn't smell good. That's a weird one, right? Before you eat, smells good. After, it doesn't smell good. It's just the nature of things, the way it works. And so this kind of gentle way of awakening is an acceptance of all things, and that's the aspect of compassion then. The compassionate attitude is like Lompa Samhita says, it all belongs. Morally, some things are appropriate, some things are inappropriate. Socially, responsibilities are appropriate, irresponsibilities is appropriate, right? That's at the convention level. But in terms of stream of consciousness, it all belongs. And that's the compassionate part, where we, our attention is embracing rather than judgmental. That's the soft part of the practice. That's quite important. And then, you know, like disappointment, that belongs. Greed, that belongs. And yet you don't pig out. oh, the body's going to get fat. You're going to have to get rid of it sometimes. So why don't I just not eat so much or something like that? So you start to see the contemplative life as a beautiful cultivation of attitudes which are always freeing the mind.